The weather's so nice outside. So I want to tell you about some recent developments in a rather old subject. That subject is putting supersymmetry on the lattice. And what I'll have to say today will be it will not give you a generic technique for doing this, but it will tell you there are certain class of models out there for which the lattice and supersymmetry are not as incompatible as you might have first guessed. So I'll give you a fairly pedagogical introduction to the thing, with quite a lot of detail, but not hopefully too much. So it appears that, from at first glance, that supersymmetry and discrete space-time are essentially incompatible. I mean, the normal argument is that the anticommutator of two of the generators of supersymmetry flows on of the momentum. And of course, there's no infinitesimal generator of translations on the lattice, or equivalently, the lattice difference operators that you end up putting in to represent derivative operators don't satisfy Leibniz rule. So there are all kinds of issues that come up when you do that. And classically, you might not worry too much about that, because presumably all the supersymmetry breaking terms vanish with some power of the lattice spacing. But of course, at a quantum level, the problem is that you generically, once you break the symmetry at the classical level, everything hits you at the quantum level, and you pick up all kinds of Susie violated operators in the quantum effective action, which some of those will be relevant, and you'll have to tune the coupling from the lattice very carefully as the lattice spacing is reduced in order to get back to a supersymmetric continuum limit. And generically, that's prohibitively difficult. It's also very unnatural. So what we sought out when we started this project was to try to find out whether there was any way of preserving just an element of supersymmetry on the lattice that would protect you against those sort of dangerous radiative corrections that generically appear. And so what I'm going to tell you today is that there's a special class of theories out there where the discretization can preserve part of supersymmetry, exactly, at finite lattice spacing. These are supersymmetrized versions of QCD, and they have to have an integer multiple of 2 to the d supercharges. So we're talking about models with extended supersymmetry, and more specifically than that, they have to have integer multiples of 2 to the d supercharges. So in 4 dimensions, there's a unique answer to this question, and that's n equals 4 super Young Mills. So the lattice formulations start from not the conventional representation of these super Young Mills models, but a so-called twisted formulation. So you see the twisting procedure naturally exposes a nilpotent supercharge, and that's the one you're going to preserve when you go to the lattice. The point about all of this, of course, is it allows us to actually give a rigorous, non-perturbative definition to some of these super Young Mills theories, and that's of interest just theoretically without even using it for anything. But of course, once one has a suitable Euclidean space path integral, which you can imagine putting it on a computer and actually deriving non-perturbative information from it by doing Monte Carlo simulations. So, for example, I'll show you some sort of preliminary results we have right now for issues to do with the nature of the vacuum, some bound state spectrum of low-lying mass spectrum, bound states, things like that. Of course, these models are also very interesting because they're thought conjectured or known to be dual to certain types of gravitational systems. So again, by studying these particular theories, which come out as a sort of solution of this problem of matching supersymmetry to the lattice, you may actually also be able to learn something about at least supergravity or possibly even quantum gravity. So this is a plan of what I'm going to say. I'll talk a lot of the time. I'll be in 2 dimensions, since most of the basic ideas come up first in 2 dimensions, and they're easiest there. So I'll talk about the twist in 2 dimensions, the nature of the twist, the reinterpretation of those twisted variables in terms of what are called Kähler Dirac fields. And I'll spend some time giving you a fairly complete introduction to the lattice formulation we have of the simplest theory with gauge symmetry, which exhibits this sort of phenomenon that's theory with 2 Majorana spinners in 2 dimensions, so-called n equals 2 super Young Mills. I'll give you some results we have right now, although those are very much ongoing right now. And I'll show you how you can very quickly generalize these tricks up to 4 dimensions and come up with a lattice formulation of n equals 4 super Young Mills, which of course is one that's of great interest to people in string theory. And I'll give you some conclusions, things, obvious things that one would like to do. Okay, so in 2 dimensions is the game. The simplest theory you can come up with for which you can play this this twisting procedure is a theory with 2 Majorana fermions. So I can think of those fermions as coming with 2 indices. One is a Lorentz index alpha, which tells you how the things transform under rotations in the Euclidean plane. And then there'll be some sort of isospin index, which tells you also how you can rotate the two spins into each other, and it's a symmetry, a global symmetry of the theory. So specifically, you have this also SO2 rotation symmetry, and you also have some R symmetry. We need a piece of it, which is called, which is an SO2 as well. So there's an additional SO2 we'll come to later, but we don't actually need that for the twist at all. Okay, so the idea is to decompose, for example, your fermions, not as representations, not of the usual rotation group, but a twist or twisted rotation group, which is this diagonal subgroup, SO2E plus SO2R. So the idea is I want to do a rotation in the base space, I have to do an equal rotation in this isospin space, which is equivalent to things, essentially saying these two indices, which start off quite distinct, should be treated equivalently. So instead of having a spinner here labeled by I, I have a matrix, psi, alpha, beta. Once I have, think of my matrices, my fermions as matrices, then it's very natural, of course, to expand them on products of gamma matrices. And what you find is that the matrix can be parameterized in terms of a scalar component, a vector component, and an antisymmetric tensor. Okay. Or if I, obviously in higher dimensions, this will continue. And in general, the fermions can be represented in terms of a set of P forms, which are going to be the twisted components, the twisted fermions. That's already slightly attractive to someone who thinks about lattices, because one has an idea how to put tensors on a lattice. There's a sort of natural mapping between p-forms and simplices in a lattice. And already you sort of see this, so this is a rather natural thing to do in the context of lattice physics. Later. I mean, many of the problems with fermions on lattices are related to the fact there's really no geometrical object in the lattice that you can map a spinner field to. But there certainly are, of course, geometrical objects you can map tensors to. Okay, so just as a follow-up to that, if I write my original Dirac equation down in the top line here, if I use this twisted basis, then this is just equivalent to taking the trace over this matrix, gamma of D with itself. So that's just a trivial rewriting of the original action. And if I use this decomposition of psi, it's pretty easy to see that this can be decomposed in a completely geometrical form. So it involves a contraction of psi on the gradient of eta, and this chi field with this antisymmetric derivative of psi. So it's explicitly recast in terms of these p-form fields through what terms which are basically exterior derivatives. And in fact, the whole Dirac equation can be rewritten just as d minus d dagger on psi. So again, it's just emphasizing the sort of geometrical content of what's going on. So, it's also natural, once you discuss the fermions, to think about supercharges in the same language. So in other words, I should think of the supercharges of my theory as being, if you want, represented by this matrix, or equivalently its components, Q, Q mu, and Q of 2. If I do that, and go back to my original extended supersymmetry algebra, I'll see it gets replaced by a so-called twisted algebra, which basically says the square of this Q is gamma dot P. If I write that out in components, this is what I get. So first of all, you see there is indeed a nilpotent scalar supercharge, natural in this twisted basis. But you get far more than that. What you should see here is that momentum is also essentially Q exact. It's a Q variation of something else. That means it's plausible, although it's not rigorously, it doesn't have to be true rigorously, but it's plausible the entire energy momentum tensor is Q exact. If that's the case, then you would expect the whole action to be Q exact. And it turns out, generically, in all the theories we've looked at, this is the case. This is not a new observation. This goes back to Witten's original construction of topological field theories in the late 80s. That the actions of these theories written in this twisted basis are essentially Q on something. So they look like gauge fixing terms, VRST gauge, in that sort of VRST language. Okay, so immediately you see another advantage you buy here. If I can preserve the algebra of Q, Q squared is zero, then it's easy to build actions invariant under Q. Okay, I can stick anything in here involving any kind of finite difference operator, and it's going to not be a problem from the point of view of supersymmetry. Okay. And so that's the goal here, to try to preserve this single Q when we go to the lattice, and hope that protects me against some of these dangerous radiative corrections which obscure the usual continuum limit upstairs. I mean, one Q is already enough to pair the spectrum up and give you a zero backing energy. So one Q is a lot more than zero Q. Okay, so let's get specific. We've discussed how you can represent the fermions and the superchargers in terms of P4 fields. At this point, you might actually want to construct this model, this two-dimensional Supiang-Mills model I mentioned a couple of slides back, explicitly. So just the first observation is once I have this set of fermions, eta, psi, mu, and chi, then clearly there'll be superpartners with exactly the same index content under Q. So I naturally expect any supersymmetric theory will involve a scalar field called phi bar, an A mu, and something called B12. So the claim is that if as I told you, the action generically is Q on something, and here's the something. Okay, so the claim is that if I take the Q variation of this particular function, integrate out this B field, which turns out to be a multiplying field, I'll recover the action of n equals 2 super Young-Mills. Except that the fermions will come out in this Taylor Dirac basis, in this basis involving P4 fields rather than spins. Okay, so this is the explicit action of the Q symmetry you need. So Q takes A into a psi, takes a psi into a covariant derivative on phi. So phi is a new field that emerges at this point. Okay, you had a phi bar up here, but this phi is in principle independent of phi bar. So it parameterizes infinitesimal gauge transformations. So all of these fields in the continuum transform like G, F, G dagger under gauge transformations, where G is the default of the e to the phi, and Q squared on any of these fields gives me an infinitesimal gauge transformation parameterized by phi. So you can see that explicitly if I do Q squared on A mu, I'll just get this guy, which is the correct transformation of the gauge potential. Q squared on, say, chi will just give me a commutator with phi with chi, which is the correct gauge transformation plot for a natural field. So the claim is, and I'll show it in more detail later on, that if I take this form of the gauge fermion, do this Q variation, and subsequently integrate out the B, I'll recover essentially two-dimensional super Young-Mills. And the advantage of this whole twisted formulation is simply that those fields are now, I don't have any spinners left in the gate, I just have tensors, and tensors I know how to map to the lattice. At least I have a good idea how I might start doing that. I haven't given you the description exactly, but you can see there is hope. And there is also hope for maintaining that Q squared equals zero piece of the algebra. That's not immediately in conflict with latticization, unlike the usual supersymmetry algebra. If you're interested where the other supersymmetries are, I just showed you one of them, how they act on the fields. It's easy to recover those guys. But I write, they go back to my fermion connection, written in terms of this trace. Okay? It's clearly invariant under right multiplication by one of these gammas, one of these bases for the twisted matrices. So for example, for gamma 4, gamma 1, gamma 2, I just right multiply by that guy. Clearly it leaves the fermionic action invariant. But what it does is it mixes up the fermions. It specifically mixes up the superchargers. In fact, in this case, what it does is essentially duality transformation on the Qs. So it swaps Q for Q12, and Q mu gets replaced by epsilon mu nu Q nu. Okay, so if I want to figure out what the action of one of these other Qs is on the fields, I can just take the action of the Q symmetry itself, but I just dualize the fermions on the right-hand side, or wherever they appear. So although we're focusing primarily on the scalar supercharge, it's easy to reconstruct these other superchargers in terms of the things you know about. And ultimately, that you'll need to do this because if you want to verify all the supersymmetries restored in the continuum limit, you need to write down more identities for all these supercharges. So this is sort of structure you'll need later on when it comes to testing these ideas in practice. Anyway, so let's get on to exactly what one does to construct a lattice model. So I told you about the continuum so far, and it's clearly hope from the point of view of constructing a lattice theory, but we have to actually come up with a prescription that works. So this is the prescription. So it's natural, as I said before, to map scalars to points. Vectors go on links. Tensors will be squares, like x in my two-dimensional lattice. So I'm starting off with the notion of a two-dimensional hypercubic lattice. The gauge transformations I have now to specify. So for a scalar, the only thing you can do is essentially make it transform just like in the continuum. But when I have a field living on a link, it's natural to make it transform like essentially by the endpoints of the link. Just like in ordinary Wilson lattice gauge theory, there are two ends to the link, and it's natural to transform like G dagger at the end of the link. So unlike in ordinary Wilson lattice gauge theory, we're going to require this for all vector fields, not just the gauge link, but everything will transform like this that has a single vector index. And then, of course, it's very natural to generalize this to the case of square objects living on perfects, and make them transform like this way. So plaquette variables can be really just thought of as diagonal link variables. So if I construct my lattice like this, then here's my plaquette variable I can actually associate it with this link here. And so it naturally transforms like those two links. This seems arbitrary at this point. You'll see it's very compatible with the notion of derivative that I'm going to introduce in one slide. So there's a certain amount of choice here, and there's a reason we use these particular gauge transformation properties. They're all equivalent to the continuum in the naive continuum limit, so there's no problem. You can do whatever you want, because I'm only shifting these arguments by order of lattice space. So I replace A by U in the normal way, so I can think of that as the exponential of the continuum connection. There's one subtlety that arises at this point, which relates to the fact that once you go to the lattice and put fields on simplices, every simplex, every p cube in the lattice has an orientation corresponding to the even or odd permutations of its vertices. There are naturally two orientations to the underlying geometrical object you're mapping to. So it's natural to actually associate two fields for every one continuum field, which you can think of as just allowing the continuum field to be complex. Right? That seems like it's a choice that you could have avoided. You could have just taken everything to be real, just like in the continuum. It turns out to construct gauge invariant quantities, this is actually very important. So we don't really have a choice here, it turns out. And you'll see later on that, in fact, there are some advantages when it comes to writing down this theory and constructing its continuum limit to actually be in this sort of complexified theory. So we start off, you know, modeling the continuum, but when we go to the lattice, we, from the point of view of the supersymmetry, we have to think about a sort of complexified version of the theory. So intrinsically, the gauge group is not UN anymore, GLNC at this point. So I think about my A's as being complex. All right. That allows this to make even some sense. So I can take the U matrix into its side. So that's just like in the continuum, formally. Psi now goes into some sort of difference operator on phi. I'm going to tell you what that is in just a second. But there's a very specific form of this difference operator you need here. B will vary into a commutator of phi with pi, just like in the continuum. But I put a prime on the commutator. That indicates it's actually point split. It's point split in a careful way. So I want Q to commute with gauge transformations. So I want the gauge transformation of this commutator to match the gauge transformation of B. B is this two-form, so it has a particular gauge transformation property. If I look at phi pi, that's just exactly right. If I insert the transformation of phi and the transformation of pi according to my rules, this transforms just like a two-form. But in the case of the other half of the commutator, if I just put 5x here, it would not. So what I did was I point split the argument here so that this transforms just like this piece, and both of them transform like a two-fold. So it's important to modify commutators like that. Yeah.
If I understood correctly, if you're extending to an SL or a GLNC Yang-Mills connection, then the ordinary Yang-Mills action extended that way is unstable.
I'll show you it's not actually not our particular construction.
It isn't
real and positive boundary. Yes, right, I know what you mean. But in fact, in the end, we're going to make arguments about truncating to the real line again. But from the point of view of the formulation, we start off with these complex variables. And I'll show you an action which actually would make perfect sense deep on the lattice, even in the complex theory. So it would be real and bounded from below. So I'll show you that in a second.
So there were games like that, right?
Right.
So you make use of those.
Sorry?
There were people who found ways to keep the Hamiltonian positive definite lattice.
No, we don't. Actually, I'm not even aware of that work, so I'd like to talk to you about that later. But I'll show you an action for which it's not even a problem. But in the end, I'm going to make arguments so we can go to the real line when we're doing path intervals, at least for large beta. But I'll show you it doesn't even matter. One could actually use the complexity. Okay, so modulo some subtleties about the nature of these commutators, and something I have to tell you about here, which is what that difference operator is. It's some sort of forward difference operator, but it has to be gauged, and it has to be compatible with our gauge transformation properties. So it has to mean that this object transforms like a link. And I'll show you there are rules for doing that that allow you to do construct that. Okay, so what are those derivatives? How do they work? So there is a whole description for doing this, and it's actually rather beautiful and simple. And it only works for adjoint fields. So the game is the following. You basically, It has to be a difference for a difference operator, say if it's a D plus. So it has to be basically fx plus mu minus f of x. But I have to throw in the gauge matrices somehow. So I throw them in either side, so it looks like it's sort of, it's almost a commutator structure itself. So it's very easy to, first of all, verify that it reduces to the usual continuum adjoint covariant derivative, so there's no problem from the point of view of naive continuum limit. But it has another nice feature, that if I look at how this piece of gauge transforms, it transforms just like a gauge, like a vector on the lattice, as does this piece. So in fact, all you have to remember when you're figuring out what these arguments are, what you feel, is you have to have it gauge transform in the right way. So you know it's basically going to be u, f, the shifted point, minus f, u, and you figure out these arguments by just making sure this thing gauge transforms correctly. If I'm going to construct a derivative on the vector field, it's the same game. It's basically f nu, x plus mu, minus f nu at x, and I have to shift this argument by nu. So it's, again, like a commutator structure, you have to modify slightly some of these lattice arguments. These are unit vectors in the lattice directions in order that this thing transforms correctly. There's an adjoint operator for this, which is truly adjoint to D plus. It looks like this. Verify that. And you can make this game work for any P4. I'm just showing you the 0 and the 1, which is all I need in 2 dimensions. But in 4 dimensions, I need 3 and 4 form derivatives as well. So the first is it's compatible with this gauge transformations. And turning it around, if you start trying to construct covariant derivatives, figure out what you need, that tells you what the gauge transformations have to be, actually. It's sort of a self-existent thing. There's a very natural candidate for the field strength. It's just d mu plus on u nu using these results. This turns out to be automatically anti-symmetric in u nu without any further anti-symmetrization. It also reduces the continuum guy very quickly as you take a to 0. So if you just put u equals e to the a, expand it out of the powers of a, you'll see it's nothing more than the continuum f nu in leading order. So that's all very nice, and you can play this game in other dimensions. The real use of introducing these forward and backward derivatives is there was a lot of work done in the early 80s by Becker, Hughes, Rabin, like that, on how to latticize geometrical actions, like the one we started with. And what they proved, using results in homology theory, actually, was that you can take the continuum actions and you can latticize them without encountering any spectrum doubling if you replace a derivative by a forward difference if it's acting like a D, like a curl, and a D minus, acting from a DDAC. So in other words, when I, you'll see that in a second. Okay, so if the continuum derivative is acting like a, let's go back to it. It's a very simple prescription. It guarantees there's no Fermi without. So in other words, here, this would be a D plus. And this would also be a D plus. But if I wrote the adjoint of this, which corresponds to psi contracting with a D divergence of chi, I have to use a D minus. Okay. So there's just a rule for how you map continuum derivatives, either to D plus or D minus, depending on whether it's coming from a D or D dagger, an exterior derivative or a tangent. And remarkably enough, that guarantees you will not have spectrum doubling. So there are no zeros of Fermion operator in these theories, which live out of the Brillouin zone boundary and mess up your continuum limit. So what they proved, actually, was that the solutions of this, of the differential, the classical equations following from these actions converge uniformly to the continuum solutions as you take a to 0. So there can be no spectrum doubling. So not only have you bought some way of putting supersymmetry, some element of supersymmetry on the lattice, but you also, by doing that, you've completely avoided the usual Fermion doubling problems. As a parenthetical remark, in the weak coupling limit, this prescription I gave you would cover staggered fermions. So it's equivalent to staggered fermions for G equals 0. The gauging we have here is completely different from the standard gauging of staggered fermions that people use for lattice QCD. But the reason there are no spectrum doubles is essentially the same. However, in ordinary staggered fermion simulations, people work very hard in QCD with what's called the fourth root problem. That is, they want to simulate one species of staggered fork, and they get four automatically from this prescription. And they have to argue that the quarter power of the determinant represents one flavor, and there's a big controversy still raging about that. Here, because you're looking at a model which has two fermions in two dimensions, there's a role for every one of those flavors automatically. There's no need to take the square root of the determinant here. So these theories just naturally have the right number of fermion flavors to fill up the staggered quark sort of multiplier. So again, it's a very specific, not a generic feature. But meshes beautifully with this prescription and with the notion of a twisted supersymmetry. Okay, so to be completely concrete, here's the lattice action. You see, latticizing these theories is now somewhat trivial in terms of these prescriptions. So I write down something which is essentially like the continuum, except that I have to replace derivatives by appropriate different gauge difference operators. And you'll notice one other trick. Wherever I had a chi 1,2, b 1,2 in the continuum, I have now a chi bar 1,2, b 1,2. So in other words, you need to use the complex conjugate, the Hermitian conjugate here, rather than the field itself. That's simply because I need to make up closed loops in the lattice. And if I start spreading my fields over links like this, I have to be able to get back. So I have to form. So for example, if I had a continuum term which was like a nu of x, b nu of x, for example. Right? I'm trying to model that on the lattice, and I use my lattice gauge transformation rules that would transform like g of x, a mu of x, g of x plus mu dagger times g of x, b mu, g of x plus mu dagger, and now of course I'm tracing this somewhere. But that's no longer invariant from the gauge transformations. But if I allow one of these to be the bar quantity, emission quantity, then it will transform in just the right way, because then it will transform my g x plus mu a mu bar g of x. So then that piece will go, dagger. Well, this piece, and the cyclic property of the trace allows me to rotate those two guys into each other. And this is now, so if I work in terms of the a mu bar b, then it can be gauge invariant from the lattice. And if I take these to be totally real, I cannot take the bar field to transform differently. I have to have it to be complex. Or independent, or complex is what people use. It seems to be natural to take it to be complex. So except for that, it's very simple. You write commutators in a slightly modified way. You map derivatives in a very well-defined way in terms of those rules. And you have to work in this sort of complexified theory. So if I carry out my lattice Q variation, integrate out the Bs, I get this term. I get an F dagger F. That's my real gauge action.
No. But I mean, that's positive definite, but it's not invariant under SLN mod SUN. It's invariant only under the SUN part.
No. Well,
Because okay. There's implicitly some major.
There's a little sleight of hand thing, which is that my scalars really don't need to be complexified because they transform in such a way that I can. They don't have this g of x plus something, right? So I can actually define what I mean by Hermitian conjugation to be, in my basis, it's an anti-Hermitian, something like that. So that allows me to write something, so in other words, g to the minus 1 is equivalent to g dagger this way. So I can maintain invariance under e to the phi as long as I have this rule. So I can take my g's to be e to the phi, and be general GLNC or something.
So what it is, I mean, it's as if you have a metric on the internal space which breaks SLN to SUN, and then you gauge fix that to 1. Because, I mean, just to make invariant an object.
Well, I mean, operationally, what your problem is this G dagger is not G to the minus 1, right?
No, my problem is the G dagger under SLN in the coset transforms it wrong. If it was GG, it would transform the right way. That is, the trace is an invariant. The trace is not an invariant of the complex conjugate of the representation times the representation. What is an invariant is if you have a metric in the internal space that plays the same role of a space-time metric and breaks GL to SL, then what you would have there is, if I call it metric Q, is Q inverse F dagger Q F, and the trace back is an SLN C invariant.
Right.
So you have an implicit metric on the sort of playing the role of the symmetry breaking field, and then you gauge based on 2-1.
I guess I don't fully understand. If I make this transform like e to the minus 5, right, then this is invariant under these transformations where phi is complex. So I take phi to be complex. And what I mean by g dagger now is that is not e to the plus phi, but e to the minus phi. Then this is explicitly invariant of that transformation. So we can argue about what we call it.
So when phi is the parameter of the...
So phi is this field that prepped in at the level of introducing the Q transformation. So it's going to ultimately be taking the path integral to be complex conjugate of phi bar, of course. But at the level of construction, it's just an independent field. Right? And my argument about the orientation, of course, fails for zero forms. There's no notion of orientation about a point. So in some sense, I don't have to double up those degrees of freedom. So if I take my dagger to have this particular property, that's not inconsistent, at least with that notion. We should maybe discuss it afterwards. I mean, you raise a good point.
And I'm confused. If G is an element of the gauge group, then G inverse is G inverse is a definition of being in the SUN as opposed to the SLN. So isn't that that you're suggesting?
I think it's a question of...
I mean, if all you want is that...
all I need is what I said.
Yeah,
so maybe it's a question of
maybe another way to say it is that all you actually have and all you need is SUN gauge invariance, local SUN gauge invariance, and you're just happening to be using the complex...
Yeah, okay. I agree with that. At the end of the day, I'm going to go down from this anyway, but so we shouldn't get... But, right. Okay, so... Okay, so this is what my action. This would be my normal x squared term. The continuum comes out as f dagger f this way. That's the normal quartic for the scalar potential. These are just your powers coupling the fermions to various pieces of phi. This is the scalar kinetic piece. And this is the fermionic contribution written in the scalar Dirac language. This language in terms of people. Right. So basically, after that, it's very similar to the continuum in form. It's just that what I mean by these d plus and minus are not quite the same as the derivative. So by construction, it's invariant of the Q under gauge transformations, SUN or otherwise, which is all I'm going to be interested in the end. And also this additional U1, this is the other piece of the R symmetry in this model I didn't use in the twisting. It just corresponds to phase rotations of these fields and corresponding rotations of the scalars. So. In the language of staggered quarks, for anyone who's interested, this is the remnant U1 we'll talk about in the staggered quarks. It's what keeps the mass of the staggered quark multiplicatively renormalized, and so it's going to play the same role here, potentially, as controlling quantum corrections for masses. So you can't generate mass terms here for the fermions. So these are strictly massless simulations later, so it slows things down a lot. Practical issue. So looking at the structure of this F dagger F term, just using the rules I had for F, you can break it into two pieces. One of them is formally the same as the Wilson-Plaquette operator. Okay, so it's just you just take the product of these links around some basic Plaquette. Then the other piece here is something which basically goes up and down a link, sort of like a zero area loop in the two corresponding directions. So formally, if I'm talking about unitary U's, this vanishes completely exactly, and I just get the Wilson operator. Okay. So in that sense, what you've done is square root of the Wilson-Plaquette operator. And notice it was crucial it was F dagger here, not F. Right? You wouldn't get this square rooting of the Wilson-Plaquette term if you didn't use the dagger. So, and that wasn't put in by hand. That just fell out of the formulas. It wasn't constructed that way. So that's kind of interesting. Okay. Just to reinforce this business about doubles or the lack of them, if I put all these fields into some sort of spinner, or not spinner, but some sort of vector, sort of a Kepler rack vector. Okay, so here's my four fields, eta, chi, psi 1, and psi 2 in two dimensions. Then, of course, the Fermion operator takes a sort of this form in block. So then my Q powers will be down the diagonal, and I have these kinetic hopping pieces in the off diagonal. So if I want to worry about Fermion doubles, I can set my G to 0, because it's a property of the free kinetic theory. So I can set the U powers to 0, and set these guys, these derivatives, can just take them to be ordinary differences. So I can set the U's to 1. So what you do is, if you look at the structure I gave you for Fermion action, this is the structure of K. So if I take the, if I integrate over the fields, let's say I'm in the continuum, so I should get a factor. That's just the, basically the determinant of this k thing. And because of the structure here, this is nothing more than the determinant of the usual two-dimensional scalar Laplacian, explicitly double free because it comes up as a d plus and a d minus. So there's explicitly no doubles to this theory. You can just look at it. So all these properties are kind of nice. All right, so some comments about simulations, and I'll show you some results. So this lattice formulation is given in terms of these complex fields. And what you want to do is target a continuing theory, basically where the imaginary parts are all zero, except for the scalars which are conjugate to each other. Now, that doesn't hurt gauge invariance. You can certainly make that truncation by hand right now, and it won't change the gauge invariance. It's still gauge invariant. It still has the right naive continuum limit. The real question is whether the supersymmetric water entities are still satisfied when you make that truncation. You were forced to use these complex fields to formulate the theory. The question is, does that work? And so the conjecture is, yes, at least for large beta, and I'll show you results that are consistent with that. There's kind of an argument as to why that is, and it relates to the fact that this action is q-exact. Because it's q-exact, any q-invariant observable can be computed exactly in a semi-classical limit. That allows me to set beta to infinity. If I set beta to infinity, go back to my gauge action, something interesting happens. Okay, if I parameterize this, I use a polar decomposition of this matrix U in terms of a real SUN matrix times an emission positive Dedmon object R. It's a sort of general property you can do. And I just stick it back into my gauge action. What you find is, of course, that this piece here is completely insensitive to the little u. It just basically gives me R squared. From this length times R squared this. So as I crank beta to infinity, R is driven to 1 automatically, to the unit matrix, automatically. If I use that inside of my fermion operator, you'll find the fermion operator is also independent of R and explicitly anti-symmetric. So the real imaginary parts of the fields decouple of the fermions as well. And so the water entities in the complexified theory essentially can be computed precisely on the, in the truncated theory at large beta. Since this is an exact result because it's because these guys can be computed exactly in semi-classical limit, the two things are essentially equivalent. Or turning it around, what it means is if I simulated the real theory, there could be no fine-tuning in the continuum limit, beta goes to infinity, a goes to zero, because I match my wood entities to those of this theory which has the exact symmetry. So it's an argument really about a lack of fine-tuning. I'll show you, in the case of SU2, it holds down to any beta we've looked at. So it's precocious. It actually is much better than this result. You would expect this to be true. The water entities to work fine at large beta, as you take a to zero. But in fact, in SU2, it's even better than that. I have some ideas about that, but it's not a generic property, so it's not worth worrying about too much. You'll see that it works quite nicely. So just a word about practical things, just a word, since this is not the audience for this one slide only. So the idea is that we have to approximate a Sfafian of this operator. That's what you want to get, which you rewrite as a quarter power of the pentagram. So I'm going to throw away the phase of that for the moment. And I can always rewrite that, of course, in terms of these so-called pseudo fermion fields, F and F dagger, by just basically inverting the... this is the usual trick that's used in lattice QCD all the time. So there's nothing new about this. The only new thing, really, is that usually when people have tried to do this game before, until the last few years, this has been very tricky. To handle generic powers here, fractional powers like this, is very hard, just from a computational point of view. So people always worked in terms of two flavor simulations or something, where that power was just minus one. So what happens now, and just in the last few years, is that there's a proposed algorithm which works incredibly well called RHMC, which is an exact way of simulating this object. There are no errors except statistical. And it relies on essentially approximating this power, any fractional power, by a sort of optimum partial fraction expansion. So these alphas and betas are given by some algorithm which you can run offline. It's called the Romez algorithm. It gives you an optimal set of alphas and betas, which ought to give you a rigorous upper bound on the fractional error in the spectrum in some predefined range for any n you give it. So, I mean, in practice, n of 10 or 15 is fine. you can get an approximation that runs down to 10 to the minus 10 up to 1, and which is good to a fractional accuracy in the eigenvalues of about 0.6. So from all practical points of view, you can essentially simulate this now exact, when X is this large sparse matrix. So M, the size of M goes like the size of the system. So that's the tricky thing. All right. So this is a new algorithm that was invented just a few years ago by Mike Clark, Tony Kennedy. It's hardly been applied in QCD yet. This is one of the first real simulations to ever use it, and it's not even in QCD. So we use that, and it's nice because it allows you to go to this massive limit where you set the gluing on that to zero, and you have no issues because you know the algorithm is exact. So it's basically a standard dynamic fermion with this trick. It's important, again, that this, when you do this, you might think you have to do little ends worth of work here by solving a whole lot of linear systems. But there's another trick called multi-mass, which allows you to get this for the price of n is 1. So you can basically simulate this quarter power the same effort as minus 1 to 6, or within a factor of 2 or 3, which is an enormous practical issue, actually, for QCD. And it's also useful here. Anyway, moving on. So I'm going to show you mostly data for SU2, since it's the smallest thing and the first thing to do. These are L by L lattices, and the lattices are pretty small, either 2 points, which is about as small as you get, or 8. In terms of staggered fork simulations, that would actually be more like L of 16. This is sort of a doubling when you go to the staggered fork formulation. So it's not quite as ridiculous as it looks. And over a range of coupling, which embraces most of the interest in physics, so small numbers up to a order of 4. So the first thing to do, of course, is to check whether the supersymmetry is realized at the quantum level. So one wants to look at Ward identities, as I've said. The simplest Ward identity in this case is the action itself. The action is Q exact, so it should have expectation value 0. What that means is, since I know how the fermions behave with beta, coupling constant, I can translate this into an exact result, independent of beta, for the sum of the gauge and scalar actions. So there's an exact result, analytic result, for this sum of the gauge plus scalar actions, all the bosons. So I'll show you some data for that. So there are 3 sets of data here, corresponding to 3 different lattice sizes. I just split them apart arbitrarily just so you could see the different numbers. So I just moved these horizontal lines to the continuum 1. So this is 1, and I just shifted the data up and down to show you the lattice sizes. So what you can see is this is beta of 1, this is beta of 4. Within the statistical errors, it's almost perfect. Okay. So in other words, at least for this Ward identity, there's every evidence that at the quantum level we have full supersymmetry, at least the scale of supersymmetry. Okay, now we check other Ward identities and went up, and we've started looking at SU3, then the results are also consistent with this. This is just the simplest picture. So for SU3, notice that it works even at small beta where you wouldn't have guessed it would have done. You would have expected this up here, but not down here. When you go to SU3, it's more consistent with your expectations. There are small deviations of small beta. Small, under a couple of percent. Nothing horrible from a practical point of view. And it seems like you flow onto the line as you increase beta. I started about 10 past the night, so 15, 20 minutes. Okay, so having just checked the Ward identities, you might want to actually do some physics with this. And the simplest qualitative piece of physics you can address up front is the issue of what happens to the moduli space of this theory when I put in the quantum fluctuation. So the vacuum of this theory is any homogeneous solution which satisfies a vanishing commutator. So this would be, so in the classical theory, there are these flat directions corresponding to the Cartan subalgebra here, where potentially you could generate infrared divergence by integrating over the scales. And the question is, what happens when you put in the quantum effects? So this plot shows you 2 curves, both of which are distributions of the eigenvalues of the scalars as a function. So here's the eigenvalue. This is the multiplicity, the probability of finding that eigenvalue. For 2 different values of beta in SU2, this is the 3x3 lattice. So what you see is a beta of 0.5, so that's very strong coupling order 1. You don't find the scalars wandering off infinity, that's the first thing. Right? There is a tail here and it damps out. So the scalars don't run to infinity. In fact, they're concentrated in the vicinity of the peak. What you see is as you increase beta, go to the continuum limit, in fact, this peak shifts the smaller values of lambda and narrows. So in the continuum limit, it's extremely close to the axis there. So like beta of 4 is actually still quite small for this theory. Since there are power, since the beta runs like a power of a to the minus 2, in fact, it runs very fast. So beta of 4 is actually a small coupling, a small beta. A large beta would be more like L squared. So beta of order 10 would be a ballpark for a reasonable beta in a physical system. So the first point is these flat directions that you see classically appear to be a limit model. And that's perhaps not unexpected in two dimensions, where there are strong infrared interactions if you scale up bosons. But it's, as far as I know, the first sort of semi-rigorous demonstration of that effect. Because it's hard to do these things in perturbation theory. And of course, there's a whole spectrum of other things one could do now with this theory. This is just the two values of beta. You could look at this in the total limit.
Do you have non-normalization theorems in two dimensions like the ones before here?
No. No, the ones about the lifting of the flat directions or not lifting. No, they don't hold in two dimensions as far as I'm aware.
Not even perturbatively.
Perturbatively they do. So this is strictly a non-perturbative effect. That's a good point. Sorry, yeah, absolutely. Perturbatively they do. So this is sort of interesting. So you can only get this in a non-perturbative calculation. Here's a picture of the string tension. I show it for really only one reason, just so you can, just so from a lattice audience, this shows you can do a string tension, just like in QCD. What you notice is it's basically smoothly varying with beta. So this theory appears to have only one phase. But that's completely consistent with what you'd expect, because the partition function here is essentially measuring the Witten index. So the Witten index of this thing is expected to be coupling constant independent. So you can't get thermodynamic singularities in beta by taking derivatives, and that's consistent with what we see. The scale of confinement varies with beta, but there's only a single phase involved. I was going to say something about the phase of the Fapien, but let me put that off because I don't have time. And so maybe we'll get back to that later at the end. So how does this game work in four dimensions? Well, it's extremely similar. In four dimensions, you have four Majorana spinners, okay, which come equipped with two indices, one of which is the Lorentz index, the alpha and I, and then there's some sort of isospin index which allows you to rotate those four Majoranas into each other. Again, you can regard both the supercharges and the muons as matrices, so you can go to this twisted basis in which you go to the diagonal subgroup of those two. That means you can expand those matrices out on products of gamma matrices, just like before, and you'll pick up a scalar, vector, two-form, three-form, and four-form matrices. Notice if I count all the number of independent components in these fields because of the complete anti-symmetry of these indices, they're actually only 16. That's exactly what you need for a four-dimensional Kähler Dirac field. It's also exactly what you need for any of these four supernodes. So these twisted fermions get paired with superpartners. So there'll be expected to be a phi bar, an A mu, a B, a W, and a C through the scalar supersymmetry. Right away, you know that. Turns out the B and the C are multiplier fields. So they'll disappear from the final theory. So I'll get a phi and a phi bar. The phi will come into the gauge transformations like before. There's a vector potential. And then there's this field W, which has four independent components in it. That W plus the phi and phi bar are the usual six scalars of n equals four in this twisted basis. Explicitly, you can figure out the form of the Q transformations. They're just generalizations of two dimensions. You almost have no freedom here. You always have a structure that Q on the field gives me the superpartner, Q on the superpartner gives me some sort of generally a commutator of phi with phi bar. And the only question is whether this is Q and eta is phi bar or Q and phi bar is eta. After that, Q squared is delta. Phi tells you what structure is. And the order you write those fields just depends on whether the field is a multiplier or not. So you have almost no choice here. Right, so these clearly are nilpotent after gauge transformations, just like in two dimensions. And the real game is actually finding the appropriate gauge fermion. So you have to write the action of n equals 4 as q on something. And that's really the only place where effort is required. So you have to futz about for several months to find the right gauge fermion that gives you n equals 4. And this is the right one. So the idea is if I do the q variation I just gave you, integrate the b's and the c's in here, I'll get some action. If I take that action and replace some of the three and four form fields by their duals, I actually can recover a well-known topological twist of n equals 4 due to Marcus. There are three topological twists of n equals 4. This is the last of those to be written down in the mid-90s. So you can just go ahead and make that connection. And once you have that in flat space, it's just the relabeling of fields to get back to the normal spinner formulation of n equals 4. It's important we actually don't use the Marcus form, because it's important we keep these three and four forms on the lattice, because otherwise we won't be able to play our rules. So the only new thing in this, really, at the end of the day, is finding the right way of finding writing this lambda down so that I can keep all the structure I need to lattice X. So here's the first step in that. You would, if you did a few variations, you would find fermionic action has exactly this form. That up to rescalings by root 2 and things is just the Kähler Dirac action for a fermion in four dimensions. It's a generalization of that 2D guy. This is the bosonic action. There are some Yukawas as well, which is just too long for right now. So here you'll see this isn't the continuum still, there's an F squared. This is going to be a commutator of two scalars and a dualizer theory. Here's the other commutators with the other bona fide scalars. Here's my original scalar action. Here are my derivatives of the scalars concealed inside of the W. So all the ingredients are here for this to look like conventional n equals 4. You just have to make a change of variables and show it explicitly. So in other words, you can recast this entirely in a conventional language in flat space. If you're in curved spaces, they're not equivalent. But in flat space, this is essentially just a change of variables. So these V mu's are dual forms of the W. And so you can just rewrite the whole action, just bosonic action in this form, which is the convention. Okay. And the spinners turn out to be columns of this Kähler Dirac matrix, the two Dirac spinners. So you can just build them out, give you the rules. But that's not ultimately very important. The real importance for us is that once I have this formulation in terms of, go back to this language, in terms of this Kähler Dirac form, rather, to distinguish it from the usual twist, you could sort of say this Kähler Dirac twist of the theory, which makes it very explicit a lot of the different P forms in the theory. Once you have it in this form, the procedure I told you about in two dimensions works the same. So I map this transforms like gauge transforms like a 3-4, this transforms like a 4-4. I'll end up introducing a field and its complex conjugate for each continuum field. Derivatives go through essentially in the same way. So this will be a d mu plus here. This, which is, it would also be a plus because it's promoting you from a 3-4 up to a 4-4. When you come to construct the lattice object, you have the adjoints of those guys, so you have to use d minus in appropriate places. But it all works in essentially the standard way. There are a few wrinkles, but. So there is no barrier in principle to sticking this on the computer and actually doing simulations of n equals 4, except computer time. And this would take a lot of time. And there are some one or two issues that have to be explored. So right now, we're mostly in two dimensions to get a handle on some of those issues. But there's no problem in principle. The prescription I gave you works just as well for four dimensions. That's just the main problem, yeah.
You do the same for n equals 2 and 4 dimensions.
No, it's tricky. I don't know how to do that. And the reason is that instead of localizing on flat connections, as Marcus's twist says, it localizes on instantons. Okay? So I need to be able to write down lattice analogs of F plus self-dual field tensor, which have well-defined lattice gauge transformation properties. And the problem is, of course, that in components, this is F mu nu plus half epsilon mu nu rho lambda F rho lambda. Now, this is a constant, presumably. So this transforms like a rho lambda field. So it transforms like g of x, f rho lambda, g x plus rho unit vector plus lambda. These are all unit vectors. And this transforms like mu nu here. So this doesn't have a well-defined gauge transformation law, according to my rules. And you might say, well, that must be just a technical problem. But if you try to break my rules, that I gave you, it's actually very hard to get a consistent theory. So there's no no-go theorem, you can't do it. But it looks tricky. And if you look at the fermionic sector, it involves basically self-dual fermions. And the operation, this epsilon operation that gives you the self-dual fermion, is like a gamma 5 operation. So it's a bit like the chiral fermion problem. So the reason chiral fermions are hard in this language is the same reason this would be tricky. Okay, it uses only half the components of the k-letter rack field, so it's not natural from a lattice perspective, I think. But then it's not a hard rule. There may be possible to work around it, but it's not easy. You could try to generalize this so it gate transforms and puts everything on the same footing, and then you have to worry about applying multiplying by appropriate strings of U's or something like that. You can play games, but we haven't had to do anything that works right now. There are maybe reasons to believe that might be a general problem.
It's a little bit strange because, you know, n equal 2 in 2 dimensions is very few supersymmetries.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you can use the dimensional reductions of n equals 4. So we can construct n equals 4 and n equals 8 in 2 dimensions, because they'll involve multiples of the scalar direct fields. So you can do them by dimensional reductions of this. In fact, that's the easiest way to go. So they'll automatically be QXM. There's another reason to believe this might be tricky. It turns out very recently there's mounting evidence, basically, now that this construction is essentially equivalent to Kaplan's construction through overhaul methods. So this is going about the same time. It's been a parallel way of doing supersymmetry for the lattice. Turns out it's not parallel. It's actually the same. So the continuum limit of, for example, that four-dimensional theory, which can maintain only one supercharge, the continuum limit is not n equals 4. It's the twisted n equals 4. It's exactly this Marcus twist. So though the details of the lattice prescriptions are a little different, basically the underlying physics is the same. It's come out from completely different directions. And this twisted language is actually easier to understand than some of the overhaul stuff. But it's basically the same. So the nilpotent supercharge is essentially really a combination of my Q and Q12, for example. It's like Q minus Q12. So that's another reason. They have no idea how to do n equals 2 in 4 dimensions either. And it's sort of more obvious. All right, so conclusions and wrap up. So the idea is that, contrary to folklore, it's not absolutely hopeless to do this problem of putting supersymmetric theories in the lattices. There are this subset of them where you can play this game. It's a very small subset. It's one theory in 4 dimensions right now. But it's not an interesting theory. The lattice theories are not funny. They're local. They're free of spectral doubling. There's nothing technical going on there. They're rather natural constructions. You have to discretize by going from this reformulated theory in geometrical terms. It's related to topological twisting, but it's not the same thing. And it's very important to realize what we're doing here is not constructing a topological field theory. In a topological field theory, you demand that all the physical states are annihilated by Q, just like in ordinary gauge fixing. And we don't require that. That projects to the vacuum, and we're not interested in just doing that. So we just use the twisting as a change of variables. That's all. And in flat spaces, that's all it is. So in 2 dimensions, I haven't got these things with me, but we've done some work on this. This works for sigma models and W's Westermino models as well. And there we've done more numerical work, actually, and it turns out that all the supersymmetries appear to be recovered without fine-tuning the continuum limit. So in 2 dimensions, maintaining this one supersymmetry, at least in these non-gauge situations, seems to buy all the supersymmetries automatically and take A to 0. So clearly, we're investing a certain amount of time, or I am, right, inviting code after many years of not doing it for a while to simulate these guys. That's an ongoing process. There's lots of things one could do. We'd like to check all of these coordinate entities in the continuum limit. We'd like to understand more about the phase of the vacuum that should be coming in at long 0a. We have a minute to show you that. There's lots of things, simple questions you can ask about the quantum moduli space or lack of it. As a function of different coupling and different number of colors and different numbers of supercharges. So that's sort of something we'd like to do, start along that process now. This is possible, just hard. Probably easier to look at some of the dimensional reductions in 2 and 3 dimensions primarily. And something that I'm doing in collaboration with Toby Weisbrand right now at Harvard is to put the thing at finite temperature, so stick on temporal antiperiod boundary conditions for the fermions. And explore this theory of the total limit, taking the number of colors large, holding beta over n fixed. And see, at the moment in the four supercharge case, as a sort of a toy model for understanding, for example, you can go to one dimension and do this in one dimension, then you have basically the BFSS model with a finite temperature. And so you can try to understand stuff to do with black holes, for example. in anti-de Sitter space by actually simulations of quantum mechanics using these anti-mechanical conditions. So that, I mean, this is a sort of an open area which is obviously of interest as well. That's what we're going to be doing in the near future. This is a half a minute, and we'll just show you a picture of something else. So I told you that we were throwing away the phase of this fermion operator when we simulated. But you can always try to put that phase back in again by reweighting. So the issue is, if you measure the phase, how does it look? So here's a picture of the distribution of the cosine of the phase. It's a distribution function. So cosine of, so zero phase is cosine 1, which is here. So what you find is the phase is peaked around 0. As I increase beta, this peaking increases. So as I take the continuum limit, the phase is concentrated more and more closely around this point. That's what your naive expectation is. The continuum theory has no phase. This four supercharged model has no phase. And so on the lattice, there is a phase in general, phase fluctuation, but it goes away, apparently, rather innocuously as we take the continuum limit. So if I reweight my wood energies with the appropriate phase here to get the exact numbers, things don't change, basically, very much, especially in the large beta. So that's encouraging. Of course, when you go to 16 supercharges, you don't have the phase. There's in general a phase even in the continuum. And so it's not so clear, things will be so nice. And that ultimately could kill you. I mean, you could find the phase fluctuates around the circle all the time, even as you take beta large, if you go to some zero lattice spacing limit, and you're just dead. So you have to suck it and see. I mean, what you would do is start off with in a configuration where there was no phase and see whether it was stable under. When you start running the simulation, does it stay in the vicinity of that configuration? Is the phase a problem? Or does it wander to regions where the phase is fluctuating wildly and you can't, at least you can't do it from any Monte Carlo platform? So there's no way to know about that until you try it. So we'll look at it in the lower dimension situation first. Using anti-period boundary conditions actually improves the phase problem. So in one dimension, there is no phase at all when you switch from anti-period boundary conditions. All right, so I guess I finished. Yeah.
So presumably you haven't done yet any simulations of the four-dimensional n equals 4.
No.
Yeah.
I haven't even written the code. But it's doable, it's just a finite project. I need to go back.
So I have a stupid confusion about what to expect.
All right.
It's because so for ordinary QCD, and since it's asymptotically free, we expect to be able to tune things so that we find the critical points at zero and find asymptotic scale of variance and deviations
right.
and so forth. Since the n equals 4 super Yang nodes is exactly scale and variance and perturbation theory, what kind of limit are we looking at?
It's interesting because naively you would expect a lattice alignment at this point.
Yes.
Beta, right? Yes. So presume that can't be the case because you have these right. U matrices, so you're going to have to crank beta over some threshold before you're even continuing light to apply those sort of arguments. So I don't have rotation invariance, for example, on the lattice.
Right.
So they're all, in fact, that's something we need to check very carefully even in two dimensions.
Is it possible that.
So my naive expectation, optimistically, is you go to some sufficiently large beta that your U fields are basically at 1 plus A, good approximation. And then you see a restoration of rotation invariance, and you can even talk about scale invariance. Right? And so you need power law correlators or something. You won't see that at small beta, for certain.
Right, so the question is, did you expect there to be a beta at which dependence on the lattice spacing disappears somehow from the endpoint functions? Should there be some critical beta?
It's a complete lattice artifact thing. It's not like you're tuning to a real critical point. It's just there has to be some threshold in beta before you look continuum like at all. And then it should not run because everything should be, there should be a line of fixed points.
Yeah, is there any example like that which has been studied?
I'm trying to think. The two-dimensional XY model may be a little bit like that, is it? I mean, there's a line of fixed points, but you don't pick it up at beta equals zero. You pick it up at some finite beta, I believe, the two-dimensional XY model. So that would be the analog, I guess. Because there you start with this cosine action, and then it has to look like, a squared. So I think there is an example, but I'd have to. Yeah, I mean, there's lots and lots of interesting things. I mean, it could be that this whole scheme will collapse because you'll just find a fatty and it's just complex. You can't deal with it in the Monte Carlo and die. But at least now you have a hope of actually trying. So that, I guess that's the reason for optimism, is you can even try to address that kind of a question and think about it concretely. But it may not be a full solution.
Would you be able to put sort of quenched baryons in static format for tension?
You can do that. I can switch the fermions off right now. It runs a lot faster. Yeah, absolutely. You can do that if you want, but
there are some predictions.
Really?
What is what you can ask for?
Yeah. Well,
it's basically so it's you're in the cooling phase, and so it's, you know, you can.
That's in four dimensions, not in the dimension
two. So, but that would be something sort of physical, and again, just connection with gauge ADHC if you like those
moments. Right.
Usually it's easy to
do on the lattices,
right?
Yeah, no, you can do anything. Anything you can do in a regular lattice theory, you can do it. This construction is not, actually, at the end of the day, it's not particularly fancy. You know, it's just regular difference operators with funny U matrices coupled in here and there. I mean, any lattice person could take it away and hold it up, and they wouldn't find anything problematic. It's very concrete. I mean, except for the phase issue, it's really no problem at all that I'm aware of. There are a couple.
Can you test your Lagrangian by power expanding in lattice size to a square, and you have a bunch of unpleasant operators that still will have to behave well behaved when put inside the loops with the
continuum theory. It would be actually very nice to see these cancellations going on, because it would have to happen in perturbation.
Right, exactly. And since you have already actually read the elements.
You just power expand it and take those leading corrections, stick them in the loops and see if they generate. They're presumably not going to generate divergences, otherwise you'll have fine-tuned problems.
Or if they generate divergences, you have to be super symmetric,
in the quantum mechanics.
In front of the Taylor.
We worked on a toy model involving supersymmetric quantum mechanics, and that's exactly what happened. So if you took the smart action, there was no fine-tuning. If you took the dumb version, where you just wrote down some difference in operators, but you didn't think about maintaining the exact supersymmetry, what you find was the single counter that you could compute in perturbation theories. If you subtract that out, if you didn't subtract it out, your results, you took A to zero, or everything was crazy because of you got divergences, basically, because of this. But if you subtract it out in a perturbative calculation, then you could match the exact supersymmetry. So what was happening with the exact case is that there was an exact cancellation between two divergences that was going on as a result of the exact Q symmetry. And you could actually see that in perturbation theory. So that's sort of been done in Witten's supersymmetric quantum mechanics, which is where all this started 4 or 5 years ago. But it hasn't been done in the case of Yang Noll. And it's been very interesting to do that. Actually, I've been talking to a couple of people about whether they would do that. I don't feel comfortable to do it, because I've never done any lattice perturbation theory at all. But it's something that would be very interesting to try to do. Just to verify you know what was going on. Lattice perturbation theory is a nightmare, actually, to continue. So many, many more vertices. So it's not a good place to be if you can avoid it. But it would be useful to do like a one loop calculation and see what was happening, just instructive. So not much could happen in two dimensions, such as master normalization of the scalars, and that's prohibited because of this additional U1 plus supersymmetry. So you can kind of make general arguments by power cutting that it can happen. And because it's super normalizable, those power cutting arguments are probably okay. There's not much. Free.
Can you check the PDSFT solution for the entropy?
So what would you like to do is go compute the entropy of a black hole by looking at the free energy of the Yang-Noll's model, I guess, or something like that. So we're doing that for superchargers where there is no conjecture as a warm-up, but if it's in the same universality class, you might expect a sort of similar result. There isn't one. As far as I'm aware, there's no equivalence for the four supercharge theory. But certainly, what we're trying to do is get enough understanding of the four supercharge case that we'll get to the 16 supercharge case. We know what we're doing. So, but that's what you'd exactly want to do, right?
It's different. We know that in examples, if you reduce number of symmetry, there is no way to expect to get the same entropy. If that's
I guess that's not what you're saying.
Well, I don't know.
I don't know what you mean in the sense.
Well, I mean, for example, this theory looks like it might be gapless in the same sense. If I look, of course, it's confining, but there's a very light scalar boundary that I didn't show you in this, very light compared to the scalar confinement. And so we might hope that, you know, in that sense, it's sort of similar to the 16th super judge case. Because there isn't a mass gap. It actually looks as you find beta up as though this scale separates from the final scale. But it's just, yeah, have a rigorous argument.
Yeah, I was referring to the quantitative prediction
of
three
quantities. Yes.
Oh.
Yeah. That's very different from theory to theory.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. No, I thought you were going to. No, I
have to find it.
But you should, in principle, be able to do it for the X4 case, mm-hmm. or the 16th superjudge case, reduced to one dimension. And one dimension is easy to simulate. I mean, one of the things I've been telling the last people is that, you know, with a big computer, you can blast these things into the ground, because this is dynamical fermions, but only in one dimension or two dimensions. It's much, much easier than doing QCD in four dimensions.
But just to see if I understand correctly, in the four-dimensional theory, the setup guarantees you four of the supersymmetry charges, but not all of them. That is.
In the 16 supercharge case, now
you only have one of them.
One of them, right.
Right.
So in two dimensions, you verify that you got back the word identity for the rest of the supercharges.
We're in the process of doing that. It's been done in the Wessimino model case, and there it's true.
But that's a place it could fall apart in four dimensions.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, it's tied to this issue of the hypersonic is tied to cubic lattice, but then these body diagonals, essentially. So you don't have an exact 90-degree rotation symmetry anymore. So it's not clear that you get